Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. So, welcome to our next session on spirituality here at B'nai Tikva. And tonight we're going to be talking about environmental spirituality, or ecological spirituality. And let me simply introduce it by saying that, you know, the environment is all the rage these days. People are constantly talking about how important it is and how important it is to respect it and so forth. And all of that's true, and really it's a sort of a holy exercise, and I believe like recycling is a holy exercise. So, you know, it's a real mitzvah. And there is, we actually have a halakha, bal tashchit, which means that you should not wantonly destroy something. So a concrete example is if you've seen people like sitting around at a table and there's a styrofoam cup. And just, you know, for the fun of it, they finish using the cup and they'll just, you know, they'll sort of sit there and just, you know, to do something with their hands, they'll just like tear the cup apart. You know, it's not the end of the world. They're not doing anything catastrophic, except there's this principle of bal tashchit that you don't need to be destroying this, so don't destroy it. And it doesn't, you know, even if you're not going to reuse it or anything else, just the simple act of letting things remain whole, that translates from that particular situation that's, you know, no big deal, but it can translate into something that's very, very large in other contexts, you know, respect for the wholeness of things. But tonight, I'm not going to be emphasizing that kind of sort of environmental mitzvot. Tonight I'm going to be talking about something else, and that is how our relationship and awareness of the environment, how that impacts on our self-understanding and our association with God. And I'll give you a dramatic example of what I mean, of how it is that an environmental awareness changes our spiritual relationship with God. When somebody dies, all right, and you go to visit the mourner, and you're about to leave the house of the mourner, there's a statement that's become like the traditional statement to make, the traditional verse of consolation. All right, Hamakom yinachem etchem b'toch sharav leitzion v'yushalayim. May God comfort you among all who mourn Zion in Jerusalem. Right. But if you know Hebrew, you realize that that rabbinic phrase chooses a very particular word for God. You know, may God comfort you. Hamakom yinachem otcha. Right? Makom in Hebrew literally means place. You know, what's the place? You know, where do you want me to put this book? What place do you want me to put this book? Where does it belong? You know. Or so I came to this place. I was traveling, and then I came to this place. Came to, you know, hamakom. It simply means place. The same, basically the same range as in English, but in addition, it has this meaning of God. That God is place with a capital P. And in that, if we go back to that phrase, that may God comfort you. You know, there are a lot of different words that we could have chosen for God. Okay. May, you know, Yod Hey Vav and then Hey, may Adonai come for you, may Elohim come for you, may El Shaddai come for you. I mean, there's may the God of life and death come for you. There are all kinds of different expressions that we could use. The rabbis in their wisdom chose the word Hamakom, may the place come for you. And the implication of that, and that's what we're going to try and talk about tonight, is that everything that happens, the entire universe in which we find ourselves, all right, is part of the place, the one place where we are. We've talked a lot in previous sessions about the idea that that God is everything. And, late atar panui mineh, there's no place that's empty of God's presence. So what that means is that both life and death are part of the place that, you know, is God or is, you know, ordained by God. So it is fitting then that when you're trying to comfort somebody and you're trying to say, you know, that death is not this, you know, this abhorrent aberration from life, but rather is, you know, the partner of life, the brother of life, all right? The name that's chosen to describe God in that context is the place, right? Because all of this is part of the same place. Life and death are part of the same place. So So what we're going to explore tonight is what it does to our consciousness, our spiritual consciousness, when we become aware of the environment of this place. Right? Because that, if you think about what is, you know, an ecological understanding or an environmental understanding, it means understanding the place where you are. It's a kind of spatial awareness of where you are, a deep understanding of where you are. So with that in mind, I'd like you to look at the quote on page 1. This is a passage from the book of Deuteronomy. "For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of flowing streams with springs and underground waters, welling up in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oils and honey, a land where you may eat bread without scarcity, where you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and from whose hills you may mine copper. You shall eat your fill and bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you." Now, I've talked about this passage. It's one of my favorite passages in the Torah. I've talked about it in a lot of different contexts. You know, I pointed out just on Tu B'Shvat a couple of days ago, which is why I chose environmental spirituality for this week, because of Tu B'Shvat, the new year of the trees, that these seven species that are described here, wheat and barley, vines, it's grapevines, I mean, and fig trees and pomegranates, olive trees and honey, they're referring to date honey here, not bee honey, and date honey, that these are the seven domesticated species that existed 3,000 years ago, and Israel is basically the only place in the world that had all of them at the same time. That certainly is a kind of impressive thing. And I did not go into it on Tu B'Shvat, but it's worth mentioning now, when it talks about a land of flowing streams, springs and underground waters welling up in valleys and hills, it's talking about the fact that Israel is composed of multiple mini-climates, and each one of which, microclimates, each one of which has its own kind of water supply. And because of the different water supplies, besides the fact that they have to be nurtured differently, it also leads to all kinds of different kinds of vegetation, different animal, flora and fauna array around the water, you know, that is available, depending on the circumstances by which it becomes available. There's a difference between what happens around the Jordan River on the one hand and what happens up on top of a mountain where there's a spring. And similarly, when you're talking about the minerals underground, some of the first copper mines in the world are in the southern tip of Israel, near Eilat. The Egyptians were mining copper there from a very, very early stage, and iron, you know, can actually be smelted from the stones there. But the issue that strikes me here, the reason I wanted to emphasize this, is that if the Bible were being written, say, in the Great Plains or in the South, the South of the United States, if the Bible were being written there, the description would be entirely different. Or if it was being written in the in the Amazon rainforest, right, you would have an entirely different description. So I used to joke that. If you come from Savannah, if the Bible were written in Savannah, all right, so it would talk about things like scupper nogs and sand gnats, all right, and a cool breeze at Tybee, things that somebody from the north, would have no idea what I was talking about, but somebody in the south would immediately recognize all of these things, as tasty as bald peanuts on a hot day. Nobody in the south, they know what I mean. It becomes obvious. So when the Torah is trying to encourage us to to get an appreciation for our land, when it says, "Eat your fill and bless the Lord your God for the good land He's given you," they're trying to talk about you have to anchor yourself in this particular place. It's not just a general idea that, oh yeah, thank you God, but it's being anchored in this particular place. And notice the wisdom of this, You shall eat your fill and bless the Lord your God, not for the food that God has given you, but for the good land he has given you. And that's why when we do the Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after the meals, Al Ha'aretz V'Al HaMazon, we bless you, God, on the land and on the food. Right? So the awareness of the land that you're in, that's the consciousness that they're trying to get you to develop here. Yeah, you say a blessing every time you eat a particular food. And it's a blessing that's sort of specific to the type of food that you're eating. But what the Torah is trying to give you an awareness of is that you are supposed to bless God for being on the land in which you find yourself. All right. And so that was an awareness that's been incorporated into the Birkat HaMazon, which in a traditional context people are reciting 2-3 times a day, every day. Okay. And even to the point where if you do there's a mini blessing that if you don't eat bread, but if you eat in any of the seven species, it's a blessing called Alamichya. The things that keep us alive, the nutrition that keeps us alive. And you vary the blessing depending on whether, say, the olives that you're eating, you vary the blessing on whether those olives actually came from the land of Israel or say, Greece, okay? That if they actually came from Israel, you make a point of saying this, you know, its fruit, as opposed to the fruit. You make a point of reconnecting it to the land. Right. So for our ancestors, an awareness of the land as a gift from God and a broad awareness that everything, whether it's the water or the flora or the actual dirt under our feet, you know, the minerals that you gain from it, but, you know, on every level, this is all from God. And the consciousness of that, you know, that is something that permeated our sense of self. Now, contrast that to this wonderful poem by Aaron Kramer. They've lost it. Lost it. And their children will never even wish for it. And I am afraid that the whole tribe's in trouble. The whole tribe is lost because the sun keeps rising. And these days, nobody sings. And I think it's a very short poem, but I think that it really has captured one of the main problems, arguably the main, but one of the main problems in modern social consciousness. Is this lack of, certainly, of appreciation, not just gratitude, but lack of appreciation for the wonder of the world. You know, the sun rises, and you're supposed to sing. And I would just mention that, you know, one of the songs that we were walking the Torah around on weekdays, it talks about, you know, Su Sharim Roshechem, that the gates, you know, open the gates. And the image that's being described there is that as the sun would rise in Jerusalem, and it would rise in the east over Mount Scopus, what would happen is that the rays of the sun would go in through the huge copper doors in the temple. And besides the fact that they would sort of pierce all the way into in the depths of the temple, but since the temple was covered with white marble, as soon as the sun rays hit it, the thing you could see the glow of it from like 40 miles away. All right, so the sun rising was considered to be an almost explosive awareness of the presence of God. And now it's like, you know, you roll over, go back to bed, you know. So Abraham Joshua Heschel, in this next quote, he talks about radical amazement. All right. Radical amazement has a wider scope than any other act of man. While any act of perception or cognition has as its object a selected segment of reality, radical amazement refers to all of reality, not only to what we see, but also to the very act of seeing, as well as to our own selves that see and are amazed at their ability to see. Okay, that simply put, every single aspect of our being is utterly miraculous. And certainly every aspect of what it is that we are seeing out there is utterly miraculous. All right? The complexity just in this room, one specific example, the benches that we're sitting on, right, probably contain, I don't know, a billion trillion atoms. You know, astronomical numbers, all right? Not to mention the fact that what we know from, you know, from unfortunate experience is that there's probably enough energy contained in these benches to blow up the world. You know, if you were, you know, messed around with the nuclear, you know, if you did somehow a fusion of the carbon atoms that were in here. I mean, carbon atoms are mighty stable, but you know, you get the point that if somebody were able to split one of those or to fusion with one of those, you know, it's the big mushroom cloud picture. You know, that's what powers the sun. Right. So we are sitting in this room, and this nice sort of normal thing. I'm sitting on a chair, whatever. But in fact, there's a universe of power that's right here, right? And it just multiplies how much stuff there is, how much incorporated energy there is, right? And that's even before we start talking about things like beauty and utility, right? And the fact that we can appreciate it, that we can see it, right? The rabbis would remark that the great thing is that we know that God created us in His image, that God created us in His image, and the even greater thing is that we know that God created us in His image. All right, so it's that's what Heschel's referring to, is that sense of radical amazement. So we have a prayer that we recite on Shabbos morning, the Nishmat prayer, Nishmat Kol Chai. Right, the breath of all that lives praises You, Lord our God. The spirit of all flesh exalts You, our sovereign always. And then it goes on to say, and it's one of my favorite passages in the Siddur, could song fill our mouths as water fills the sea? Could joy flood our tongues like countless waves? Could our lips utter praise as limitless as the sky? And could our eyes match the splendor of the sun? I'll explain what that means in a second. Could we soar with arms like eagle's wings and run with gentle grace as the swiftest deer? Never could we fully state our gratitude for 1/10,000th of the blessing, dearest God, granted to our ancestors and to us. Okay, so we are supposed to have this sense of massive blessing. Who are we? We are blessed. We are gigantically blessed. We are blessed beyond the point of being able to express it. And all we can do is look to the natural world around us for the, sort of the metaphor of how much the skill that we would need to be adequate to the task of thanking God for even a fraction of what we've received. Okay, the splendor of the sun thing, this is a little known fact. To understand this, they're fudging the translation there. It's not a question of like the beauty of the splendor of the sun. In medieval optics, the way that they thought the eyes worked was that they were basically like flashlights, and that the stronger your eyes were, the more they were able to sort of like cast a light on the things that you were seeing around you. That's what made you see. So your eyes were like flashlights. And so if your eyes were as strong as the sun, you know, even to be able to see that much, it still wouldn't be enough to adequately, you know, praise God for everything that was done. Okay, so it's not just the splendor. It's not like, they should glow or whatever. But that if we had the internal power to see with the strength of the sun, you know, if our flashlight beams were as strong as the sun's, that still wouldn't be enough. So here you have this combination, and it's a remarkable picture of massive blessing of integration into the world that is blessed in all of these different ways, radical amazement at all of this, and a complete feeling of inadequacy when it comes to, you know, me, little me, you know, saying something about it. All right. That the only way you sort of can come to grips with all of this is by saying, yeah, I am not adequate to this task. So therefore, what I need to do is stop thinking about myself as this little individual thing because it's so minuscule. And what I need to do to emphasize instead is my participation in this big, massive thing. All right, because the more I do that, the more I become a part of the world. It's not just me trying to come up with ways to praise God, but I put myself together with all of those other things that are trying to praise God. So I participate in the chorus, and the voice of the chorus is stronger than my own voice. So in terms of our awareness or lack of awareness, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, earth crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries. Again, these poems that pack such an incredible wallop. All right, first that expression, earth's crammed with heaven. I love that expression. It's like, you know, the turkey is, you know, has the stuffing in it. All right, that all of normally think of, you know, heaven sort of like up there or out there someplace as opposed to earth. And instead, very much to the opposite, you know, heaven is just, you know, shoved into, you know, every nook and cranny on earth is filled with heaven. Every common bush afire with God. What's this referring to, obviously? You know, the burning bush, you know, the bush. But what she's saying is not just the burning bush, every bush is on fire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. Remember when Moses, see, and we talked about this actually in some context. I forget, it was a sermon that when Moses, you know, Moses sees the burning bush, and then says, "Oh, I have to go and check this out." All right, and then it says, "And when God saw that Moses had turned to see, all right, that's when God spoke to him." The implication being that if Moses had just blown it off and didn't turn, then God never would have said anything to him at all. Okay, but if, you know, once you see, you take off your shoes. You know, you anchor yourself in this ground. You know, you feel the grass under your feet. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries. So, I'm sorry?
They don't see it.
They don't see it, and so for them, the world is utilitarian. You know, that they'll use the world, and, you know, they might taste the blackberries and say, "Oh, that's good." But the miraculous, the awareness of the miraculousness of it, right, that's not there. So eating food that tastes good, that's one thing. Eating the same food that tastes good and realizing that it's a miracle, that adds a whole other dimension to it. You know, I have often had, very often, when I'm tasting something that's wonderful, I have often sort of said to myself, you know, flippantly, you know, "Good work, God." You know, but and the deeper level, isn't it amazing that the universe has been set up in such a way that I could have the experience of this taste? Right? That's a deeper understanding. It tastes the same to me as it would taste to somebody who just was, you know, eating a blackberry. But my ability to appreciate it, both in terms of tasting it, but my ability to, like, feel not just physically but spiritually satisfied by having it is that much greater because I realize what a miracle it is. It didn't have to be there. It didn't have to exist, but it does. Isn't that remarkable? Okay. So, this, having this awareness or not having this awareness, really that's one of the, to be or not to be, to have the this radical amazement or to not have the radical amazement. Right? So let's look at the Walt Whitman quote. "I swear the earth shall surely be complete to him or her who shall be complete. The earth remains jagged and broken only to him or her who remains jagged and broken. I swear there is no greatness or power that does not emulate those of the earth. There can be no theory of any account unless it corroborate the theory of the earth. No politics, song, religion, behavior, or whatnot is of account unless it compare with the amplitude of the earth, unless it face the exactness, vitality, impartiality, rectitude of the earth." So what our perception of the world, our ability to perceive the world, is linked to our internal spiritual state. If we are jagged and broken, then the world will look jagged and broken. Right? If we are complete, if we are whole, shleimut, if we are whole, then the earth looks whole as well. And what does it mean that the earth looks whole? What would that look like? Look at the Mary Oliver poem on the left-hand side. "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things." You know, I'll tell just a personal story. In my hometown in Scranton, there's a beautiful reservoir, Lake Scranton, not a particularly creative name, but it's a beautiful reservoir. And there's a 5-mile path that goes around it. And my father, may he rest in peace, would walk around the lake every day. And it's one of my favorite spots on earth. My father would, he would walk around it. And he would always note, and he really had a tremendous sense of awareness. He really was able to appreciate even, a flower blooming or, a fish jumping or whatever. And he would always note when the Canadian geese were flying overhead. He was always fascinated by, the V echelon that they would form. And he would, wherever we were, remember, I lived in Europe for many years, and, whether it was in New York or Connecticut or Israel or wherever I was, my father would always report on the geese. And, he saw them flying and in what direction they were going in, north, south. And to this day, when my kids hear the Canadian geese, they all go, "Hi, Grandpa Myron." Because they've heard the story from me so many times. All right, harsh and exciting, they call to you, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. And when I think about my father's passing, which of course is obviously sad and all the rest of it, but if my father were here right now, he would just think about the geese, and they come and they go, and that's the way the world works, and he would always emphasize that to us. And it is, I've always felt this way, but certainly after the passing of my father, that awareness of the seasonal change and the passage of life and the normality of the passage of life was a source of unbelievable comfort. Right. When my father died, it was just part of his life, of what was going to happen in his life. And so it was not that sort of traumatic, terrifying, gut-wrenching horror. It was what was supposed to happen. You know, it being grounded, it was being part of the family of things. Right. So, in the bottom of the page here, you have a prayer. This is a Baha'i prayer. And I just, the Baha'i, if you've ever been to the Baha'i in Israel, the Baha'i gardens, that are just exquisite. They're sort of a little bit Baroque, but they are, you know, just absolutely beautiful. And the Baha'i really try and create an atmosphere of harmony and acceptance. So Baha'u'llah is the founder of the Baha'i movement. Blessed is the spot, you know, that's Hamakom, all right, the spot and the house and the place and the city and the heart and the mountain and the refuge and the cave and the valley and the land and the sea and the island and the meadow where mention of God hath been made and his praise glorified. Now, parenthetically, the fact that Baha'is are being persecuted in the Middle East, it's like, this you want to persecute? Somebody who thinks this you want to persecute? You know, this, but, all right, leaving that aside, I don't want to do the politics of it right now. All right, but look at what how does he define the human identity? What is it that... What is our life about? All right. Our life is about praising God. And any place where you do that is the place. And it's the mountains and the valleys and the sea and the island and this and that, anywhere you want. And they're all blessed. Any place where God has been mentioned and his praise glorified. Okay. So that's... If you think about, like, what is ritual practice about? Ritual practice is about not just making this place sacred, but making this place sacred. You know, the world as a whole sacred, because this is now a place. You know, when we do our praying, this is now a place where God's name has been mentioned and his praise has been glorified. And by then connecting to our place and sanctifying our place, that puts us in some kind of harmonious, perhaps harmonic, but harmonious connection with the place. Again, the point that I'm trying to emphasize here is that, you know, we have our ritual practices, and our ritual practices are they are utilitarian in a certain way, or pedagogical. You know, they teach us good values. And they teach us how to be good people, and you know, which is all wonderful stuff. But that's only, I don't want to say superficial, but that's only a part of what these ritual practices are about. They're not only didactic. They're not only good teaching tools for appropriate behavior. They are also tools for connecting us on an existential level to the God that we are praising. And that's a level different from, I don't want to say a level above, because I want to denigrate the other, but it is a different level and a less obvious level than simple moral instruction. You know, so when people would say, well, you don't have to do all this stuff, as long as you're a good person, they're really missing a fundamental element about what religion is intended to be all about. And yes, of course you should be a good person, but spiritually speaking, that's only part of the process. Right? The deeper part is a kind of awareness. Because when you have that deeper awareness, that leads you to places that you would not get to simply by trying to be a good person. You see that on the next page, page 3. How wonderful, O Lord, are the works of your hands. The heavens declare your glory. The arch of sky displays your handiwork. In your love, you have given us the power to behold the beauty of your world robed in all its splendor. The sun and the stars, the valleys and hills, the rivers and lakes all disclose your presence. The roaring breakers of the sea tell of your awesome might. The beasts of the field and the birds of the air bespeak your wondrous will. In your goodness, you have made us able to hear the music of the world, the voices of loved ones reveal to us that you are in our midst. A divine voice sings through all creation. All right. Remember when we were walking around the room taking the Torah? Kol Adonai Bakoach. Kol Adonai, the voice of God, is heard in strength. Okay? If you listen hard enough to the world, what you're hearing is the voice of God. All right? It really is out there. And being able to get ourselves to perceive it, how do we do that? Okay? Well, one thing we have to do is to notice that world around us, to not ignore those things. And I'll give you just one example that I incorporate into my own personal life. If you head over to the east side of town, near Riva Road, there is this little lake with a little waterfall. It's a little dam that comes over. It's right down the block from the Chabad house. Whenever I pick up my kids at school, that's the way we come home. All right, and whenever we get there, as we're going over like the little bridge where the stream goes underneath the bridge, I always stop the car there. And you know, if I can, if there's no traffic coming, then I will sit there for a minute and we'll listen to the water coming over the waterfall. All right, and we'll talk about the snow or the ice, or you know, are the ducks out, or the geese out, what's the state of the trees, how much water is coming over the waterfall, whatever. Now, it's probably costing me 5 minutes to come home that way rather than to go down Riders and then Route 1. Okay. But if I went down Riders and then down Route 1, you know what I would see? Traffic. A lot of traffic. All right, you know, coming at 4 o'clock on Riders Lane, and 4:30 on Riders Lane, and Route 1. Now, you can see God's wonders in traffic too, but that's asking a lot. Okay, this way, it's just I'm making the conscious attempt, all right, to go to a place that bespeaks God's wondrous will. Okay, and to be able to hear the music of the world, you know, when I hear that waterfall going over. And I have no doubt at all, and it gives me great satisfaction, that when my kids are older, you know, when my kids are my age, they will remember, as I remember walking around Lake Scranton with my father, they will remember that every day we went by the waterfall so that they would be able to hear it. And it will mean something to them, and they will do something similar, God willing, with their children. All right. If we look on the right-hand side of the page, because I want to keep on fleshing this out, this, both the perception and also how you are transformed by having the perception. Earth Mother, Star Mother, you who are called by 1,000 names, may all remember we are cells in your body and dance together. I love that image of what we, you know, of what we are. We are cells in the body of the earth, or the body of the universe. You are the grain and the loaf that sustains us each day. And as you are patient with our struggles to learn, so shall we be patient with ourselves and each other. We are radiant light and sacred dark, the balance. You are the embrace that heartens and the freedom beyond fear. Within you, we are born, we grow, live, and die. You bring us around the circle to rebirth. Within us, you dance forever. I'm almost speechless, you know, and that doesn't happen to me very much. what a tremendously balanced perception of the world. What great humility, all right, to see ourselves as part of everything else that's going on. You are the embrace that heartens and the freedom beyond fear. You know, in our nefesh world, we've talked about the difference between the nefesh and the shama. The nefesh is paranoid, right? Our sort of earthy soul is it's like a mad sheepdog running around trying to take care of us, thinking about all the things that can go wrong. Our neshama, always connected to God, is eternally calm and harmonious. And it is a source of great spiritual both strength and also relief when we can align ourselves with our neshama rather than with our nefesh. That we can align ourselves with that harmonious sense of self and link to God as opposed to our nefesh, which is the world of struggle. You know, do not go quietly into that dark night. Right? Well, no, actually, it's sort of better to go quietly into that dark night. You know, you don't have to fight all the time. There's a time for acceptance, too. I don't know. I've seen the name around. Believe it's Native American, but I don't know. I don't know. I'll have to. As a matter of fact, as I put this together, I've been under time pressure, so I didn't have a chance to track it down. But I would like to know. Okay, Rumi, on the other hand, who we're about to read, is a great Sufi master. Okay, the Sufis are sort of the mystical strain within Islam. Right. And Rumi is known for exquisite spiritual poetry. And so this is one example. Lord, the air smells good today, straight from the mysteries within the inner courts of God. A grace like new clothes thrown across the garden, free medicine for everybody. The trees in their prayer, the birds in praise, the first blue violets kneeling, whatever came from being is caught up in being, drunkenly forgetting the way back. Okay, let's unpack that a little bit. The air smells good today, straight from the mysteries within the inner courts of God. Stunning. That even the smell of the air, if you perceive it the right way, you know, the smell of that fresh air, that too is a divine mystery. All right, it comes from that same divine source as all of the other wondrous things, you know, the Grand Canyon and this and that and the other. The air, too, is just as miraculous and just as mysterious and just as linked to God. It is a grace. That the air you breathe is a grace. You know, and going back to Nishmat Kol Chai, before Nishmat Kol Chai, one of the psalms that we read right before Nishmat is Kol Hanshama Tehallel Yah, and which is usually tried, every soul or every living thing will praise God. All right. Kol Hanshama Tehallel Yah, hallelujah, hallelujah, Kol Hanshama Tehallel Yah. All right. But also you can translate it as that every single breath is a praise of God. That's a praise of God. All right. And one of the more powerful experiences I've ever had as a rabbi, and it's something that's happened, I've been involved in it a dozen times or so, is being in a room when somebody is breathing their last. And often there's the sort of strained breathing as a person's body is shutting down. And you'll hear, the inhalation and the exhalation and the back and forth, and you're sort of waiting for the next, and it doesn't come. You know, and there's this sort of dividing line there, and then you realize what you had been hearing before, the rhythm of that breathing before, and how miraculous that breathing was. That, you know, the air that goes into my lungs to keep everything functioning Every single breath like that is a miracle. So that air is a grace to us, right? A grace like new clothes thrown across the garden, free medicine for everybody. Okay, that it heals our spirit. The trees in their prayer, the birds in praise, the first blue violets kneeling. All right, all of these things, when they do what they do, when the trees grow and the birds sing and the flowers look pretty, you know, whenever they do all of that, they came from being with a capital B. They stem from the divine source, and they are caught up with being with a small b, you know, just existing, doing what they do as they exist, drunkenly forgetting the way back. That is to say that as we live our lives, many of us, perhaps most of us, don't even really think about the divine origin from which we have come. We forgot all about it. Right? Others, you know, the seekers try and sort of trace their way back to where they came from, you know, and to the mystery of it. But for the most part, a lot of people just, you know, go on about their business. And he refers to them as drunkenly forgetting the way back. That it's a kind of, not hallucination exactly, but an unclear consciousness about who we are and, again, how miraculous we are. You know, I don't want to be too political about it, but when you look at the savagery that you know, is going on in the world, the horror of it, and you ask, how could human beings actually do this to each other? I mean, what is wrong with them? You know, now I suppose somebody in a sort of extremely pacifistic, you know, say a Quaker position would say, you know, that anybody, even in self-defense, being physically violent to somebody else is over the line. You know, and we could argue about that. But the idea that somebody would take an innocent civilian, you know, an unarmed civilian and behead them or something like that, it's, you know, how drunk are you? How warped a perspective this is. I mean, this too is a part of the earth. You know, it is a darkness that is a part of the light, but oh my God. It is, you know, talk about somebody who's forgotten their way back to God. You know, the people are saying, I'm killing in the name of God. Those are the ones that have forgotten most of all their way back to God. So a lot of what I've been talking about tonight has been incorporated into Jewish ritual practice. So one example of that is from Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, one of the great Hasidic masters, lived about 200 years ago. And this is a prayer that he would say before he would go out into the woods. He did this every day. He would go out to the woods and sort of be alone out there, and sometimes would actually sort of shout out in the woods, you know, talk to God in a very demonstrative manner, because by forcing himself to do that, he was forcing himself to articulate his deepest thoughts. Grant me the ability to be alone. May it be my custom to go outdoors each day, among the trees and grasses, among all growing things. And there may I be alone and enter into prayer to talk with the one that I belong to. Right. So here, what strikes me about this is that he knows that it is a struggle to be alone. And he knows that it is a struggle to be in communication with the one to whom he belongs. Right? He was aware that he belonged to God, but even for him, it was a struggle to be able to talk to the one to whom he belongs. And so he needed to be alone to do it, and it is very difficult to be alone. It is very difficult to go out and simply cut off the sort of the blather of what goes on in our social communications that so much gets in the way of the deeper spiritual understanding that you would have when you are sort of alone with God. And what he would try to do is that he would try and bring a continuation of that sense of being alone with God, that he would try and bring that back. So he was living, I don't want to say a schizophrenic life, but that he was trying to live a dual life, that when he would come back into society and he would be with his Hasidim and be the leader of his community, that there was still a part of him that was alone communing with God. But he made it into a consistent personal spiritual practice to go and do this. Now, we don't necessarily have to do exactly that ritual practice, but in terms of seeing the world where we are as a sort of spiritual arena, that's a really important part of this. You know, just as an environmental or ecological understanding changes our perception of the world, it also changes our perception of ourselves. So if you look at the Jewish prayer there on the right-hand side of page 3, and God saw everything that he had made and found it very good. And he said, this is a beautiful world that I have given you. Take good care of it. Do not ruin it. It is said, before the world was created, the Holy One kept creating worlds and destroying them. Finally, he created this one and was satisfied. He said to Adam, this is the last world I shall make. I place it in your hands. Hold it in trust. Okay. So everything that we do in the world, every choice we make, is can be measured against the measuring stick of, well, you know, how are we doing in terms of handling the handling that to which with which we have been entrusted, right? Does this, you know, does this action that I'm about to perform, does that is that consistent with the goal of handling this world with trust? Let me say a few words about this idea of God destroying the world. It's a fascinating thing. There is an idea that God kept on creating worlds, but none of them were perfect enough to live up to his standards. And so he would make it and then he would destroy it, and then he would make it and he would destroy it. And this kept on going and going and going until finally mercy came into the picture. And when mercy came into the picture, God was able to make a world that, even though it wasn't perfect, he was able to live with it because of his character of mercy. All right? And that's why, if you look at the beginning of the book of Bereshit, the beginning of Genesis, there are two creation stories follow on each other. And in the first one, it's Bereshit Bara Elohim, that it's Elohim, and Elohim is related to the concept of justice, as we saw today when we were studying that Elohim, this is what Sam was pointing out, Sam Rosenzweig, that Elohim, it means God, but it also means judges, and human judges. So when God made that first creation, it was, you know, Elohim, the God in this aspect of judgment, of justice. But when you look at the second creation story, it's Adonai Elohim. It's the merciful and just God that creates the world. So mercy in that has been introduced in that second story. So that's where the rabbis got the idea that God kept on creating and destroying until finally mercy came into the picture. And that's why you have a world that combines both justice and mercy. When we ask ourselves, you know, what are we supposed to do vis-a-vis God? We're supposed to be praising God and recognizing the majesty of what God has done. In practical terms, we're supposed to be nurturing the world, you know, and treating the world as in a fashion appropriate to protecting that with which we have been entrusted. And with that in mind, I found this quote at the bottom of the page, you know, really powerful. Lord, make this world to last as long as possible. The prayer of an 11-year-old child on hearing of the Sino-Indian border fighting. All right. It's a pity that little kids have to talk like that, but you can understand why. All right. That we should not have to think about, you know, the world lasting as long as possible. We should just think about the world lasting. But we keep on pressing the limits, or, you know, people keep on pressing the limits. So what I want to do in this last page that we're going to look at here is that I want to talk about, you know, you might think that from, you know, what I was, the sources that I've been quoting, that this is sort of a lot of more or less trendy, new agey type of stuff. And that it's not really sort of well integrated into Judaism, but just sort of a modern sensibility, and we're looking for Jewish sources to match that modern sensibility. What I want to do now on this last page is to demonstrate that what I just said is not true, that this is not just a modern sensibility, that this, in fact, is something that is, you know, inherent in absolutely normative Judaism and has always been. And whether you look at it from the sort of more rational point of view or whether you look at it from the more mystical point of view, that in all cases, this radical awareness that Heschel is talking about is a fundamental part of our self-understanding, our understanding of God and the world, and our relationship with God and the world. So we'll begin with the great rationalist Maimonides from the Mishneh Torah, you know, very close to the beginning of the Mishneh Torah, his great law code. He says, it is a positive commandment to love this great and awe-inspiring God, and also to fear God. As the verse states, you shall love the Lord your God, that's in the Shema, and you shall fear the Lord your God. Okay. But how does one learn to love and fear God? When a person contemplates God's works and God's great and marvelous creatures by thorough study, he sees from them wisdom that is without estimate or end, and is immediately filled with love and praise, and longs ardently to know the holy name, even as David said, my soul thirsts for God. So when you see the awesome complexity of what's out there, the marvel of it, all right, you will be drawn, filled with love and praise, and long ardently to know the name, to understand this God that created all of these things. And when a person thinks about these mighty matters, he draws back and trembles and realizes that he is a minute creature, lowly and dark, capable only of a little knowledge in the presence of perfect knowledge. As David said, when I consider your heavens, what is man that you are mindful of him, mortal man that you have taken note of him? Now let me just mention before I go on how skillfully Maimonides, by choosing two Davidic sources, you know, two psalms that are composed by King David, or at least for Maimonides appear to be composed by King David, what he's saying is that it is perfectly understandable that human beings have this ambivalence in their own self-perception. On the one hand, you know, to love and to fear God's name. That these two attitudes or approaches are intimately linked. That when you really understand, when you see how miraculous the world is, all right, you love. Attached to that, automatic in that, is a humble awareness of how small you are and how big the universe is. And that the two of those dovetail with each other. They're intimately linked perceptions, to love and to fear. You know, King David saw them both. They were both part of his awareness. On the one hand, my soul thirsts for God. I'm just desperate to, you know, to have that, you know, think about what it means to be thirsty, how much you want that drink. On the other hand, what is man that you are mindful of? And, you know, I'm nothing. In accordance with these sayings, I explain great principles from the works of the Lord of the universe, so that there may be an opening for one who wants to understand to love God. And then he goes on to, you know, describe the universe as he sees it. About such love, the sages said, that by it one comes to know who spoke, Misha Amar Vayaulam, the one who spoke, and how the universe came into being. Okay. So it is, you know, through that intimate love that you get to know God. So the love of the world, the radical amazement that comes with that, the feeling of love, not only is, do you have the corrective of the fear of God, the sense of smallness before God, but also you have that love that leads you to the knowledge of God. All right. Now, a Hasidic take, a mystical take on this, is from Sefer Itulei Torah, and it's quoting, go back to the poem that we read about Moses and the burning bush. Do not come closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. All right. And the Itulei Torah does a really beautiful and radical take on this. You need not come closer to the mountain. All right. You don't have to go to Mount Sinai for this. For the place on which you are already standing is holy land. You know, right here is holy land. Now, in this case, the place where you are sitting is holy land. That is, because you are standing upon it, you have sanctified this place. And it is from your place that holiness will come forth. Okay? So, just think about this for a second. When one has this deep awareness and this connectedness to God, it's not like, okay, I have to go from here to Tibet to come into contact with God. Right? No. My holy place is right where I am right now. Right? If I can become fully conscious. And if I become fully conscious, right, my full consciousness sanctifies this place. Because my full consciousness is my awareness of myself as part of the place with a capital P. So just as God's presence in the bush sanctified that ground, God's presence right here sanctifies this ground. And because I am standing on it and I am connected to God, you know, if I had that awareness, then every place I walked, I would be sanctifying. Okay. There is, if I remember correctly, in the movie Avatar, the science fiction film that came out a little while ago, there's certain places on this sort of miraculous planet where he's walking around where, you know, as you step, there's a luminescence, you know, with every step that he takes, the ground sort of glows. You have that phenomenon sometimes in the ocean that, you know, if you're swimming in the ocean, every time you touch the water, it glows because of the plankton in it. And if you could just imagine that, if we were at that level of consciousness where we fully were linked to the environment around us and the wonder of the environment around us, every step we take, it would be like our steps were lighting up the ground. Right. Because you are standing on it, you have sanctified this place, and it is from your place that holiness will come forth. Similarly, when people gather together and are engaged in words of Torah, they purify and sanctify that place. Now, this to me, that's a stunning thing, and it's a good way to sum up what we've been talking about. Right. He's making a parallel here between this broad environmental consciousness and its link to holiness, which is not an immediately obvious Jewish spiritual technique. He's making a link between that and what is the most obvious common Jewish spiritual technique, the study of Torah. And just as we, by studying Torah together, make this place a sacred place, so too somebody with this environmental awareness is making that place a sacred place. It becomes sacred through the consciousness of it. So we then, by our consciousness, shape the sacrality of the world. If we are aware, we make the world sacred. If we're not, we just pluck the blackberries. So, however, I'll conclude here. And any questions? Okay, so let's go and get some miraculous nourishment.